Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group Podcast, your source for current issues within the legal practice. Today, the Federalist Society's Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group is hosting a discussion on Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. Today we have with us Professor Rick Hassan, who is the William H. Hannon Distinguished Professor of Law at Loyola Law School, and Mr. Steve Simpson, Senior Attorney at the Institute for Justice. Moderating this podcast is Professor Eugene Volokh, Gary T. Schwartz Professor of Law at the University of California, Los Angeles School of Law.
Hi, this is Eugene, and I'm going to briefly introduce the Citizens United case. The issue in the Citizens United case is to what extent corporations and labor unions have First Amendment rights to speak out about candidates, including by spending money in order to speak out about candidates. The case is not about contributions made to the campaigns of candidates, nor is it about corporations and unions' rights to speak out about ballot measures that had been established some 30 years ago in the First National Bank of Boston versus Bilotti case. The case might be also about the right of media corporations to speak out about candidates. Media corporations, like other corporations, speak by spending money. Current campaign finance law exempts at least certain kinds of media corporations. So, in fact, they are not bound by the statute as written, but there remains the underlying question whether that's a constitutional protection they have, whether they're constitutionally entitled to spend money in favor of and against candidates, or whether that's just a matter of legislative grace. On these issues, the Supreme Court said that yes, corporations and unions are entitled to spend money, again, independently of the candidate campaigns. But that was by a 5-4 vote, and the four dissenters took the view that as a constitutional matter, no such right exists, and that the government may indeed restrict the spending of money by those entities. The other thing that also did not come up is the broader question of whether individuals have the right to spend large amounts of money to support and oppose candidates. In Buckley v. Valeo, the U.S. Supreme Court held at that point by a 7-1 that individuals do have such a right, but since then at least some of the justices who were in the dissenting Citizens United have spoken out in favor of upholding restrictions even in individual independent expenditures, but that was also not at issue in the case. So I hope that's a good summary of what the issues were, and now I turn it over to our panelists.
Hi, it's Rick Hassan from Loyola Law School in Los Angeles, and I think I've been asked to be on this podcast because I'm an opponent of the court's decision in this case. I think I would want to make three points against the portion of the opinion holding that corporations have for-profit corporations have a right to engage in unlimited spending independently supporting candidates for office, for federal office, but I think by extension for any office, including state and local office and judicial elections. I'd make three general criticisms of the opinion. And these, as I said, these go just to the point on the spending limits. I agree with the portion of the court's opinion, which Eugene did not summarize, upholding the disclosure requirements that apply in this area. First, I would say that the court never should have decided this question. I don't like the label judicial activism, but I think that what we can say in this case is that the court reached out and decided an issue that it did not need to decide. And there were a number of ways that the court could have avoided deciding the issue. In the first place, the court generally does not decide issues that are not raised in the petition that goes to the court, in this case, the jurisdictional statement on appeal, and this issue was not raised there. Second, the issue was abandoned below, and the Supreme Court generally doesn't decide those issues. Third, there's a principle of constitutional avoidance, which the court applies to avoid deciding difficult constitutional questions when there are adequate statutory basis to decide the issue. And here, I think the dissenters were correct that there was there were a number of adequate statutory bases, including the argument that the communication here, which was through a video on demand system, simply was not covered by the statute. We can go into more of that later. But the bottom line is that the court had to reach out and decide this issue. No one thought this case was going to be a case, a major case about this question, but the court thought that it was, the majority of the court thought that it was the right time to decide it despite these impediments. My second major criticism of the case is that I think that it is based on either an unrealistic, naive, or disingenuous view about the empirical support for a key component to the analysis. So to back up for a second, in Buckley versus Vallejo, the court said that contribution limits were constitutional, or could be generally constitutional, because of the state's interest in preventing corruption and the appearance of corruption that can come from large contributions going to candidates. In this case, the court said that independent expenditures cannot be justified on anti-corruption grounds because independent expenditures cannot corrupt. And I think that is simply incorrect. I believe that independent expenditures can corrupt. I believe they certainly can create the appearance of corruption. And we can talk about the details of that. But under the Buckley paradigm itself, I think the decision is wrong. The court should not have decided in all cases for all elections that it's simply impossible for independent expenditures to corrupt. My third criticism, and this is the one that goes further than the court was willing to go, I should say further than the court dissenters were willing to go, is that the decision fails to recognize that there are competing democratic values here. It's a point that the dissenters actually recognized in other cases. Justice Breyer, in his Shrink Missouri opinion, Justice Stevens, in his opinions in various cases. There's a value of political equality that needs to be valued against a value of free speech. The problem is that we have a system that allows for and indeed requires a great disparities in economic wealth. If we're going to have a capitalist system where there's competition, that certainly is good for our economy to have people trying as hard as they can to make as much money as they can. The problem is when that economic wealth is translated into a disparity in political influence. And so it's this anti-distortion principle that the majority rejects. And I think that especially in the case of corporations, which don't exist as people and don't have the same kind of autonomy as real people, I think the balance should have been struck differently. I think there are difficult constitutional questions. Eugene mentioned the media exception, and I'm sure we're going to get into that later. But I don't think the court should have categorically said that the state doesn't have a strong interest in trying to create at least some rudimentary political equality, and that that specific campaign finance laws need to be considered in terms of the balance between the need to have robust, strong discussions of candidates and issues on the one hand, and this desire to fulfill the goals of political equality, which are enshrined in our Constitution and have come across in the one person, one vote cases and these the other political equality cases of the Supreme Court on the other. That is, there are constitutional issues on both sides of the equation, as Justice Breyer said, and the court majority refused to engage or accept that as a permissible basis upon which to have any regulation. So those are my three main points, and I think now we turn it over to Steve.
Well, thanks very much, Rick. This is Steve Simpson from the Institute for Justice. I'm a lawyer that litigates campaign finance cases. And I have a different view of Rick than this case. I think Citizens United was a terrific case and was correctly decided. So let me go through those, and then I'll hold off responding directly to Rick's points until the rebuttal. As I said, I think Citizens United is a great case. It's not only one of the best and most important campaign finance decisions in a generation, it is certainly one of the best First Amendment decisions the court has ever handed down. And as I said, I think it was absolutely correctly decided. And to kind of step back and take what I would call a more fundamental approach to this, I think the best way to understand why the case was correctly decided is to really take the simple view. Start with the First Amendment itself. The First Amendment is simple and straightforward. Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. Citizens United involved a law passed by Congress that restricted the distribution of a film and would logically have applied to other communications media as well. Now, it did so, that is, the law at issue restricted the distribution of this film, not despite the fact that the film criticized a candidate. And remember that political criticism is at the very core of the First Amendment. It's one of the reasons that we have a First Amendment. It did so precisely because of that fact. In other words, the purpose of campaign finance laws is largely to prevent people from criticizing candidates if that criticism and the money they spend to bring to bear on that criticism is seen to be unequal to the criticism or the money that others can spend or to create concerns about corruption. Now, in my view, if a law that allows restricting a film that criticizes a candidate, if that is not unconstitutional, it is hard to conceive of what law would be unconstitutional under the clear terms of the First Amendment. Now, one can argue, as many people have, that preventing a corporation from spending its own funds on speech is and instead requiring it to set up a highly regulated separate group known as a political committee is not an abridgment of speech, but the court has quite rightly long held that restrictions on spending for speech amount to restrictions on speech itself. That holding follows from the pretty simple, simple reality that in order to speak to a large audience as politicians and others in political campaigns want to do, one must spend a large amount of money. One can also contend, as many people have, Rick included, that in theory, at least, corporations should not have First Amendment rights because they're not actual persons. There is something to this argument, but I view it as a very highly technical argument and one in which the horses in large part left the barn. That is, holding that would require and would have required the court in the Citizens United decision to overturn at least a half century of precedent in which the court has held, without much fanfare, it should be noted, that corporations have essentially the same rights to freedom of speech as individuals. Indeed, ultimately, a corporation is a voluntary association of individuals. It should have the same First Amendment rights as any group that individuals can form, from nonprofits to partnerships to any other form of association. So there is really no warrant and unions as well. I should emphasize that, which Eugene rightly did, and we often forget that unions are logically included within the decision itself. Rick has also pointed out, and others, I was going to address this as part of my initial comments, so this isn't by way of rebuttal here, but that many people have contended that the court should have ruled more narrowly and that not doing so is a version or a form of judicial activism. I share Rick's concern with the term judicial activism and judicial restraint. I am by no means same side as conservatives who criticize judicial activism, and I think those terms really have no meaning. But ultimately, what we need to understand about this decision is that the Supreme Court has, on many occasions in the past, overturned precedent when it has become clear that precedent conflicted with the First Amendment. It did so in Lawrence versus Texas not too long ago, and long before then, Brown versus Board of Education. Indeed, the primary dissenter, Justice Stevens, who wrote the dissent, has called for overturning Buckley versus Valeo in the past. Those who have criticized the Citizens United decision have cheered that and have themselves called for overturning Buckley versus Valeo. So the idea that somehow Citizens United is an outlier because it overturned precedent, I think is just a myth. I'll deal with and address some of Rick's additional points on the question of whether the court should have reached out and decided this case. There's more to be said on that. But ultimately, the question should come down to, was this law in conflict with the Constitution, not the secondary concern about whether the court was engaging in judicial activism or overturning precedent or like. The constitutionality of this law was much more important than whether the court was reaching out to decide it. Ultimately, my point is that I think the primary criticisms of Citizens United are entirely tangential. They have little to do with corporate rights or judicial activism. They have everything to do with the fundamental disagreement about the nature and meaning of the First Amendment. And this really picks up Rick's third point, which again I'll address in more detail later on. But and that ultimately gets down to, is the First Amendment fundamentally about an individual right to freedom of speech, which is to say you are allowed to speak as much as you want on whatever topics you want, and the government cannot prevent you from doing so. Or, as Rick points out, and Rick believes, does it also embrace kind of a more democratic value of democracy? I'll say more about that, but I disagree completely with the idea that it does. But ultimately, we need to recognize that we have the First Amendment that we have. It is pretty clear, in my view, in what it protects and what it does not allow. And the founders did not pass the First Amendment to promote equality. They passed it to protect an individual right. The Supreme Court recognized that in Citizens United, and that is ultimately why the decision was correctly decided. Thanks.
This is Eugene speaking. I wanted to use the moderator's prerogative to ask a couple of questions, one for each of the panelists. Steve, let me start by asking you this. So the restriction on corporations using money to speak could be viewed as just the same as a restriction on you or me, but it could also be viewed as a restriction on a government granted benefit, the corporate form, and one that leaves open the opportunity for individuals, including the individuals who've organized themselves together in corporations, to speak using money that doesn't flow from the corporate form. If I were told that I can't spend more than $1,000 to support or oppose a favorite candidate, well, that would dramatically interfere with my ability to convey my views. On the other hand, I'm a partner in a small software corporation that I co-own with my father. If I were told that corporation can't spend the money, well, then my father and I could independently spend all the money we want. The rights of individual actual human beings wouldn't be as directly affected, it seems to me. And in fact, we could even just get together into a non-corporate association to do that. So I wanted you to speak to that and the argument that I take it we agree that corporate rights don't flow from the fact that corporation is a metaphysical person. Corporate rights flow from the rights of actual human beings who organize themselves within corporations. And those human beings retain the right to speak. They can't speak precisely through that form, but they can speak through other forms. So the question is, would that be an acceptable condition on a government benefit to say, look, if you want the benefit of the corporate form, you can't use that that for certain purposes. You're still free to speak. You just have to speak without taking advantage of that benefit.
That's a very good question, Eugene. Thanks for a number of reasons, not least of which that I'm litigating cases that actually get to that issue. So I appreciate you allowing me to talk about them. But let me first say at the outset, and this kind of gets into, I guess, the weeds of corporate law and corporate philosophy, I reject the idea that the corporate form is somehow a gift from the state. I think that's completely wrong. And I think in modern times, a lot of, if not the majority of kind of corporate law scholars, or at least many of them, would agree with me that a corporation is not in its essence something that the state just sort of magically forms, as John Marshall apparently saw it back in the early 19th century. A corporation is really a collection of individuals that create the corporate form via contract, and you can actually create what amounts to a corporation without the formal corporate form if you want to, just simply by entering into a number of contracts. Certainly, that would be a heck of a lot more complicated, both for the individual setting up the corporation, than simply having general incorporation statutes that allow you to accomplish that much more simply. It would, by the way, be enormously difficult for a number of other parties as well, not the least of which would be plaintiffs' attorneys who want to sue corporations, courts who want to have you know, a simple way of filing complaints against them and a vast array of other people. But leaving all that aside, and I guess, well, one more point here would be from the time of the founding, when a lot of the views that corporations are artificial creatures of the state created or arose, corporations have changed drastically over the intervening few centuries since that time. So I reject the idea that this is a gift by the state, corporate statuses. But let me get to, I think, what may be a more substantive point, which is one of the premises of your question, is that the individuals who operate the corporation can simply go out and spend the money on their own. Well, that really isn't quite true. In fact, the campaign finance laws treat pretty much any group, at least the federal laws do, pretty much treat all groups ultimately the same. That is, even if you try to create a group that is unincorporated, you are still burdened by many of the exact same restrictions that apply to corporations, or at least that was true up until very, very recently. I'm litigating a case now called SpeechNow versus FEC, and the basic theory of that case or approach of that case is that a group of individuals should be able to do the same thing that a lone individual can do. One individual received a ruling from the D.C. Circuit in this case, could spend millions of dollars on express advocacy, do exactly what a corporation can now do. If he joined with others, he was suddenly limited to $5,000, as were all of the members of that group, to devote to the group speech. That is not treating a group the same as an individual. It is, in effect, treating that group the same as corporations were treated before Citizens United. Now, there are minor differences. Rick may disagree. But ultimately, the campaign finance laws imposed precisely the same sort of restrictions on other groups. Now, what does that tell us? It tells us first that there is no magic here in the corporate form, that the idea that campaign finance restrictions on corporations flowed solely from the fact that corporations are, quote, artificial persons is a myth. In fact, we hear the same complaints about individuals who spend a lot of money, about individuals who get together and form unincorporated associations, and those unincorporated associations spending a lot of money. Indeed, when we won the SpeechNow case, or at least the portion that struck down the limits on individuals devoting as much money as they wanted to a group's speech, we heard exactly the same complaints as were lodged against Citizens United. This is going to lead to people spending too much money in elections. So that's ultimately what this debate comes down to, and I don't think really has anything to do specifically with the corporate form. And I think Rick recognized that in large part in arguing that it is independent expenditures themselves, in his view, and I think he shares the same view with many other campaign finance reformers, that create concerns here, and that we need to question the premise that people, however composed, should be able to spend as much money as they want. Ultimately, I rest my view on this. The Supreme Court has quite rightly protected the right of association. Forming whatever sort of group you want should be as much a right as speaking alone.
This is Rick. Do I have a quick chance to respond here?
Sure, by all means, please. By all means, please.
Yeah, so I think it's interesting to go back to, this has taken a little turn towards the SpeechNow issue. I want to come back to the very basic point of Citizens United and the idea that somehow there was a huge stumbling block to this group running its anti-Hillary Clinton infomercial or documentary being imposed by the government. Now, way back in 1986, the Supreme Court recognized that if you were a nonprofit corporation organized for ideological reasons, you were not subject, for constitutional reasons, you were not subject to the limitation on spending your general treasury funds on express advocacy. So if you're the Massachusetts Citizens for Life and you want to say vote for Smith or vote against Jones, absolutely no problem. The only limitation is if you're going to be one of these groups, you need to follow some rules like not taking any for-profit corporate or union money. And this rules in there to make sure that an ideological nonprofit doesn't become a conduit for for-profit corporate or union money. Now, why couldn't Citizens United, which is one of these nonprofits, why couldn't they take advantage of this form? Well, the reason is that they took a little bit of for-profit corporate money. Why did they do that? I think they did that to manufacture a lawsuit. And I think the purpose was to try and push the limits of the campaign finance laws and to try and get an increasingly deregulatory Supreme Court interested in these kinds of cases. There is no question. I just debated at a Federal Society event here in Los Angeles. I just debated one of the lawyers for Citizens United who said it was just a small amount of money from the corporations, from for-profit corporations, that was going to Citizens United. So really, that little bit of money did not have to be taken. It was no impediment. This whole thing could have been done without any kind of problem. I think Eugene's question is absolutely right. That is, any individual shareholder, officer of a corporation, member of the corporation, can express himself, has the autonomy rights, can spend money, can do all kinds of things without us having to give corporations, which have limited liability and unlimited life and no human existence, the ability to engage in the same kind of activities that we give to normal speaking human beings.
Thanks very much for the responses. Let me now turn to Rick and ask, I'd like to ask you a question. So media corporations are business corporations. Media corporations have protection from limited liability. They have a great deal of political power. They may have less money than GM, but they do speak out a lot. They have large audiences. They're listened to by their audiences. Some of them, at least newspapers, are sometimes the one newspaper in town. The one at least local newspaper in town. And one could certainly imagine the ability to endorse a candidate or to oppose a candidate as being not only unegalitarian in some respects, newspaper editors end up having much more power than you and your I do, but also potentially corrupting. If the newspaper publisher decides he doesn't like some law, either for ideological reasons or because it's bad for his business, he could certainly try to kind of implicitly convey to politicians that, look, if you don't do the right thing on this, we're going to come down on you like a ton of bricks during the next election campaign. So one would think that if indeed business corporations can be stripped of, or I shouldn't say can be stripped, that begs the question in some respects. If indeed business corporations do not have the right to speak about candidates, then it would follow, it seems to me, that that Congress could, if it wanted to, apply the prohibition to media corporations as well. It doesn't now, but it could repeal the media exception. And now, I suppose some people may say, well, business corporations are protected by the Free Press Clause and other people aren't, and they get this, media corporations are protected by the Free Press Clause and other corporations aren't. But that kind of sort of special preferred constitutional status for media corporations, I don't think fits with the history of the Free Press Clause, nor with kind of a sound modern approach. Just the very process of trying to draw the lines between who's really a member of the free press, who is just becoming a member of the free press for a day by renting a billboard or trying to distribute a movie, or for that matter, whether bloggers, for example, are members of the free press, that would itself pose some pretty substantial problems. So, Rick, I wanted to ask you, what do you think of this? Do you think that, in fact, Congress, setting aside whether it ought to and whether it would, that Congress should have the constitutional power to bar editorializing by media for or against candidates, or even bar slanting coverage of the media for or against candidates on the same sort of equality, constitutional tension, and anti-corruption rationales?
Well, let me back up first and quibble with a portion of your question, where you said that if it's permissible for the Congress to bar corporations from speaking out in favor of candidates. I don't think that's what we're talking. We're not talking about, say, a decision of Walmart or Google to endorse a candidate for president. I think that nothing under the former law would have prevented an endorsement. And certainly under the former law, Walmart or Google could form a PAC. That PAC's decisions as to who to endorse and what money to spend could be directed by the corporation. There's no problem with that. There doesn't have to be any separation of identity or wall or anything like that. So if you want to know who Walmart or Google wants for president, you'd be able to find out. So I disagree with part of the premise. This is not about whether or not we can know whether Walmart or Google thinks that President Obama is doing a good job or not. This is about whether or not thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars or millions of dollars can be spent by for-profit corporations to try and influence the election and influence the, I would say, probably the legislative agendas of candidates for election. And on that question, for the reasons I've both the anti-corruption and the political equality reasons I've given, I think that at least some types of limitations on corporations should be constitutional. I think the media question, the media corporation question, is the most difficult question for those on my side, on the pro-regulatory side, and Eugene and I have been writing about this issue and talking about it for a long time already. What I would say is that regardless of where the doctrine has been and whether or not the free press clause should have independent meaning separate from the free speech clause, I think what Justice Marshall recognized in the Austin case, that principle, which is that the media serves a different function than in its creation of news and in its dissemination of news and varied opinion, that function is different from the function of a traditional corporation, and that when a corporation is engaged in that news and opinion function, it is serving democratic values, and therefore the difficult balancing that I think needs to be done in this area could be struck differently when we're talking about the choices made by Congress to regulate for-profit corporations that are not in the media business than those that are.
Rick, if I can just have a little bit of a follow-up. Doesn't it sort of assume the conclusion to say that the media have a different and therefore more constitutionally valuable function when they editorialize about candidates as opposed to when using, of course, their general treasury funds than some other business corporation has when it editorializes for or against the candidate? Why, even setting aside for a moment LA Times' coverage of candidates in its news stories, why is the LA Times running an editorial for or against the candidate or running op-eds, let's say, that are disproportionately for or against the candidate? Maybe the LA Times wouldn't do that, but certainly magazines might and other newspapers might. Why is that more constitutionally valuable than General Motors or Toyota expressing its views with regard to a candidate? One would think that from the perspective of the voters, this is speech that is relevant to voters and that voters would think through and analyze whether it comes from a business corporation called whatever the corporation that owns the LA Times is called, or from a business corporation called General Motors.
Well, I think the answer to that question is mostly historical. And I think that the historical answer is that the press has played this role historically. And that creates, and we can get into this if you like, that creates difficulties now with the rise of new media. But I think that those in the business of disseminating news and opinion have served a function in society that's different than the function served by, General Motors' main function is to produce cars, and it is not to provide a forum for the discussion of democratic issues. And so I think that historically we can recognize that there is something that's existed called the press, and it has served a different function, and that function is democracy enhancing. And so at least for those who accept political equality as a basis for regulation, that we could draw distinctions between what at least has traditionally been considered the press, what the function they have served, and the function that for-profit corporations have served. On the corruption point, I think there's maybe something different to say. And as I understand existing law, or the law that existed before Citizens United, it certainly was possible that a media corporation could be subject to these laws if it was actually engaged in a kind of corrupt exchange of, an endorsement for, in exchange for a politician voting in a particular way or something like that.
This is Steve. Can I jump in, Eugene?
Sure. Sure.
A couple points, and then Rick is, and you, Eugene, have raised a lot of different points. Let me try to make a big picture point. I think that one of the fundamental problems with Rick's view and those of his colleagues and allies on the opposite side of this issue is it kind of envisions the First Amendment, or it ends up with an approach to the First Amendment that treats it almost like the tax code. I mean, we have so many exemptions, different approaches, and special tests, and the promise of much, much more where that comes from, that after a while, you have to wonder how anybody would ever be able to navigate their right to free speech. So, for instance, just in the space of a few minutes now, Rick has endorsed an approach which basically says that media corporations are now to be treated differently from other types of corporations. Nonprofits are to be treated differently from for-profit corporations. We're going to have a raft of rules that defines precisely the contours of those. Who is a media corporation, and how do we know when they are, even if we accept the idea that democracy enhancing is a valid question under the First Amendment, how do we know when they're democracy enhancing and when they're not? And who's to say that media corporations as such are democracy enhancing and other corporations, for instance, those who may point out that the government's current policies are ruining the economy, are not democracy enhancing? Well, the answer is we need a raft of new cases, new laws, and new rules, all managed by the bureaucrats at the FEC. And later on, when anytime anybody wants to speak, they'll navigate all those rules, and well, they'll just figure out exactly what they can say. I think that Justice Kennedy's point in the majority decision of Citizens United was exactly right. All of that chills speech. It makes it virtually impossible to know when you can speak and when you cannot. We ought not be embracing a view of the First Amendment that basically treats free speech like filing your tax return. So that's one main point. I want to address very briefly Rick's point that the laws at issue really didn't prevent corporations from speaking. They just sort of regulated them a bit, and it was just easy for corporations to continue. Leaving aside whether Citizens United had a real concern there, I mean, the fact of the matter is they had standing to bring the case. But I want to opine on that because I don't think it ultimately matters. The salient question ought to be, does this in the main, do these laws, the PAC regulations and the restrictions on independent expenditures, do they really affect what corporations can do? And in a substantive way. Now, I think the best and easiest way to understand that the answer to that is absolutely yes is to ask my opponents. They have now been complaining bitterly since the Citizens United decision came down that this will mean that corporations will spend millions of dollars in elections. I say I hope that it does mean that. I hope that corporations can spend. But one thing we can all agree on is this wouldn't be a controversial case. This wouldn't be a case even worth mentioning if it didn't change anything in the law. That is to say, before this decision came down, corporations had an enormously difficult time spending money in elections, and afterwards, as both sides agree, now they can do so relatively freely. I don't understand how this is even a debate. The other side wants to have it both ways. They want to claim, on the one hand, these laws didn't do anything. They didn't prevent corporations from speaking, and then when the laws are overturned, horror of horrors, corporations are going to be able to spend too much money. You know, which is it? So that's an additional point. Finally, those who support campaign finance laws constantly try to put it in this framework that assumes at the outset that the primary purpose of the First Amendment is to, quote, enhance democracy. Leave aside exactly what that means, because I'm not even sure exactly what it means. But the more fundamental question I have is, where does this come from? I don't find that that part of the First Amendment anywhere in the language of the First Amendment, or for that matter, in the entire Constitution. So I would put the point this way. Whether or not anybody's particular speech promotes or enhances democracy in the views of other people should not matter one whit. The First Amendment, by its terms, protects a right to speak out. That's how it has always been understood from the founding era on up, at least largely to today. And the idea that that freedom of speech really means equality of speech is completely unsupported and utterly unsupportable.
We're coming close to the 45-minute mark, so I just thought maybe each of you could ask the other a question, preferably something we haven't really focused on much yet, and that'll give a little bit more perspective on the issues, and then I think we should close.
Who wants to go first? Rick, do you want to go, or you want me to
Sure,
go?
Sure, I'll ask you a question.
Sure.
I don't think that in a 45-minute conference call that people who have vastly different views about what the Constitution means on political equality are going to reach any kind of consensus. But I wanted to return to one of the points I made at the beginning when I was naming my three criticisms of the opinion. And you've hit very well, I think, on the first and third. But I want to come and ask you a question about the second, which is the Supreme Court statement that independent expenditures cannot corrupt candidates. So I want you to imagine a situation where pick your favorite corporation. That corporation decides to spend millions of dollars supporting a candidate for president. Now, let's say tens of millions or even $100 million. Do you believe, as the Supreme Court stated, that a $100 million independent spending campaign by Walmart or Google supporting or opposing supporting a presidential candidate, probably by attacking his opponent, does not have the potential for corruption or the appearance of corruption?
That is a very good question, and I have to answer it by, to some extent, taking issue not with your question, because it's a perfectly valid one, but really what the Supreme Court's holding in Buckley that corruption is a legitimate, at least as the court defined, or I think I would more properly say didn't define the term corruption, is a legitimate grounds for wholesale, broad-based restrictions on speech. So I guess the direct answer to your question is, yeah, I think it could, given the sort of popular view of corruption, meaning that it could, that is a large expenditure like that could engender some sort of a reaction, or I don't know if it's quite right to call it a quid pro quo from a candidate. But I think the idea of corruption in that sense is so broadly defined as to be almost meaningless. And I think this is a large part of where the debate on campaign finance laws has centered. You have very much of a debate over what exactly does corruption mean. I think those who support stronger laws in this area, so-called campaign finance reformers, have a very broad view of corruption, which basically holds that if somebody affects what politicians were presumably likely to otherwise do, that's corruption. I don't see how that could be seen as corruption. The whole point of speaking out in an election and agitating and doing all of the other things that one does in the rough and tumble of politics is to change what politicians do. Whether a politician freely agrees that they're going to regulate banks more as a matter of economic philosophy or just thinks it's expedient to do that ultimately doesn't matter. That's what politics is all about in this country, and bringing to bear support or opposition for candidates and essentially saying to them, take this position or we will oppose you, can't be corruption. If it is corruption, then the very idea of our constitutional republic or the democratic aspect of that is inherently corrupt. So on that definition, I mean, certainly that sort of thing can happen. Now, if you want to take it from the standpoint of quasi-bribery, it is certainly a possibility. It's always a possibility that people can misuse their right to freedom of speech. We see that throughout every area of freedom of speech. I mean, people can commit fraud, they can lie about other people, they can commit libel, et cetera, et cetera. But that is not now, nor has it ever been, and nor can it be, a reason for broad prohibitions or regulations on speech. The bottom line is we have to live with the possibility of abuse. And I think here, where it is so difficult to even define what corruption is and to cabin that definition to you know, particular actions or types of speech rather than others, as for instance, independent expenditures, maybe one would argue should be regulated, as I think your side does, Rick. But on the other hand, if we're going to do that, why not regulate endorsements as well? Oprah Winfrey endorsed Obama, and I think a couple grad students calculated the value as in the many millions of dollars. Why not regulate that as well? Soon we are really regulating everything that people do in the political arena, because all of those things are beneficial to candidates, and all could be said to create concerns about corruption. I think we have to take a very principled stance and say, even though this could lead to the appearance of corruption or what people typically view as corruption, that's life. Okay, Rick, I have talked a good bit about whether or not the First Amendment is primarily protecting an individual right versus democratic values, and I think we've gone around on that. So I think that's one of the fundamental points of disagreement, but I want to ask another question that I think is often ignored by your side. It seems like kind of a wonkish, you know, in the weeds of campaign finance law point, but I think it really is extremely important. And it gets to the complexity of these laws. And you'll recall that Justice Kennedy recounted, I think it was 71 different types of separate entities under the campaign finance laws and many different types of speech. Maybe it was 30 types of speech and just an 11-part test that arose right after the Wisconsin Right to Life case. I have made the point that I think your view would even add more of those tests. How do we determine what is democracy enhancing? Who is the media? Who's a journalist? How do we really cut these fine distinctions and make them real in practice? So my question is this. Aren't you concerned, as a man that I think, you know, quite rightly at least is in favor of, you know, individuals being able to speak out, being able to participate in political elections, leaving aside corporations for a moment, but looking at all of the various people who want to and have a perfectly legitimate right to affect politics and participate in elections, aren't you concerned about the extreme complexity of these laws? And don't you think there's something to Justice Kennedy's and the majority's concern that that will chill speech?
Let me just begin very briefly with a quick response to your last answer, and just point out that I think that the concern is not one about illegal bribery, but one about a system that would allow for legalized bribery. All right, so now to answer your question, I am concerned. I do think the law is too complex. I think part of that complexity is due to the fact that since the 1970s, society has not reached a consensus about how to balance First Amendment interests and robust speech on the one hand with the government's very important interests in preventing corruption, and I would say, and promoting political equality on the other. That has led to the federal election regulations being quite complex, and I certainly would support measures to make them less complex. I don't think that a person who wants to engage in grassroots, small-scale political activity should have to file any kind of paperwork with the United States government other than something that's very basic and easy to fill out without an election lawyer. I do think that those who are sophisticated political entities can handle it, that it becomes a cost of doing business the same way that it's a cost of doing business to engage in other kinds of activities. I think that to the extent that we can reach consensus, I think that we can move towards simpler rules, but we don't live in that world. So the question is how you achieve that balance. And I started off, in my opening statement, when I got to my third point, I said that these are not easy questions. For those who take seriously, as I do, both of these interests, that is both the interest in having robust strong political speech and activity, and those who care about these other issues as well, the concerns about preventing corruption and the appearance of corruption, concern about political equality, these are difficult questions. And sometimes the answers are complex, but we live in a complex world. And if we throw up our hands and say, let's just keep it simple, let's just allow for legalized bribery, to me that's not an appropriate answer to questions that require nuance and deep thought. I think on that, that's a good note for me to end on.
Gentlemen, thank you very much for participating. It's been a very enlightening and lively discussion. Hope that our listeners have found it the same. And all the best to both of you in your projects.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For related materials to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.